July 1, 1431. The Battle of Higuerula, Granada, Spain. The Sultan of Granada was defeated by the Spanish in the famous battle.
For 700 years, the Christians fought the Mohammedans. This battle was just one of many. The Spanish could never be certain which side the Jews would be on. Higuerula was led by Isabella's father, King Juan II of Castilla.
1431 was also a unique moment in contemporary history of the Jews.
They were an integral part of the army of Sultan Muhammad IX, fighting the Spanish, the Catholic soldiers of King Juan II. They allied themselves openly with the Muslims against the Christians. In the famous Royal Gallery frescoes in Madrid, the Star of David is depicted frequently in the 1431 battle for southern Spain.
Some 60 years later, King Juan II's daughter, Queen Isabella of Spain, and her husband, King Ferdinand, expelled the Jews from Spain.
In the beginning, there was a Habsburg possession called the Spanish Netherlands. In 1492, the Jews were expelled from Spain, and many of them moved up to the Spanish Netherlands. And the big city that benefited from this was Antwerp, which became the entrepot. It was a crucial location because now you had Atlantic commerce beginning. And suddenly you had this city that was at the edge of the Atlantic commerce, the Baltic commerce, and the intra-European Rhine River commerce. And so it was exactly in the right place at the right time. And the Jews went there. They also attracted the Anabaptists, who were the first cutting-edge revolutionary movement following the Protestant Reformation. And so a lot of Jews went there, and it became a big commercial center. And then rebelled. There was the Iconoclast Rebellion. They were basically going to steal the Spanish Netherlands from the Habsburgs. And the Habsburgs reacted by sending an army in, the Duke of Alba first, and then the Duke of Parma. And the Duke of Parma was basically invincible and started to proceed, taking it back one city at a time. Could not reach the northern provinces because of geographical issues. Largely, Holland is the delta of the Rhine. And it is very low. It's called Les Pays Bas, Die Niederländer, the lowlands. And it's easy to flood. And so basically the Dutch, who knew what they were doing, could flood fields and the armies could not proceed. And so eventually they had to just concede the independence of the northern provinces. At this point, the Spaniards had reconquered Antwerp. The Jews then moved from Antwerp to Amsterdam. And this is the beginning of the rise of Holland, beginning around 1609, to one of the great trading powers of the world. I mean, totally out of proportion to the land mass and population. So to give you an example, there were 20,000 ships in the 17th century, 20,000 European ships, 500 French ships, 2,000 English ships, and 15,000. Dutch ships. They were the masters, but the problem was that it was Jewish predatory behavior. You had the Jews involved, you had demi-Jews who were known as Calvinists, and they held the moral law in contempt. And so they were always involved in some type of theft or some type of exploitation, and they annoyed everyone, including the English, who then went to war with Holland and in effect defeated them. Cromwell passed the Navigation Acts in 1651, which basically cut back on the Dutch ability to be shipping magnates. And they won the war, and so Holland just sort of receded. But I think it was this general sense of excess. They went too far. It was just too, you can't have successful commerce, you can't have successful economic system based on theft. So capitalism is by definition always at war with success, because someone is always plotting how to steal something from someone else. And in a sense, that's what the system of that, if you take it all together, is called mercantilism. And the big reaction came by the end of the 18th century, when people like Adam Smith would say, this is self-defeating behavior. This is wrong with it. The physiocrats started it first, but then Adam Smith, and that became the beginning of modern economics, where you realize that, okay, gold is not wealth. Okay, and there are certain behaviors that are self-defeating. All these tariffs, if they're taken to excess, they become self-defeating. It's better if we can do what we're good at and trade with other people, and that will be the best avenue to wealth. So the Dutch, because of their excess, because of this excess in Jewish predatory economic behavior, overplayed their hand, and they were defeated by a superior military power, and then they went into a state of eclipse, I think, ever since then. You don't hear about, you know, New Amsterdam anymore. That was a Dutch colony. They just went into eclipse. The Jews were heavily involved in the early colonization attempts in America. But most of the Jews we're talking about were Sephardic. We're talking about Sephardic Jews who had come from Spain and Portugal. And these were where the colonies were. And so the Jews were involved in commerce already with the Levant. And so now they just headed off in a different direction. When they moved to Holland, they still had these contacts, and they were going back and forth to places, usually in South America.
Jews were also very prominently present in non-Dutch parts of the Caribbean, places like Barbados, places like Jamaica, St. Thomas, and many of the other islands as well.
First Masonic Lodge was in Newport, because it was basically Jewish traders who had ships going there. The first synagogue, they established a synagogue there, and they played a huge role in commerce, and commerce at that point was basically the triangular trade, where you'd get slaves and you'd ship them over in those ships, and then you'd drop them off in the Caribbean, and then you'd get sugar or rum, and then you'd take that north to New England, and then you'd get wood and turpentine and tar, and then you ship that back to England. So you go back and forth, and then you take manufactured goods from England and go back down again. And so you'd have this, keep the ships full going around that way. And the Jews were heavily involved in that.
The Jewish involvement in the African slave trade begins, as far as I can tell, long before the actual slave trade across the Atlantic itself. The transatlantic slave trade has its immediate origins around about 1441, when Portuguese sailors landed on the West African coast and kidnapped a few Africans, brought them back to Europe. Africans were brought back to Europe, to Portugal and to Spain, as part of that particular trade for several years. Columbus, of course, arrived in the Americas in 1492, approximately half a century later. In 1502, the first Africans were brought to the Caribbean. The Caribbean is where the transatlantic slave trade begins. For over 100 years before Africans were brought as slaves to this country, the United States of America, Africans were being brought across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, to places like Hispaniola, the island which today is shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and to other places as well. Jewish involvement then in that transatlantic slave trade precedes by many, many years, perhaps by 1,000 years, the actual beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. The earliest multinational corporation involved in the Atlantic slave trade was something called the Dutch West India Company. Even in this early period, globalization was already a fairly entrenched phenomenon. The slave trade was a great example of globalization. Here you had the Dutch West India Company, out of Holland, of course, which went to West Africa. They had their own private army. They established forts on the West African coast. They had their own colonization, via private enterprise. It was like privatized colonization. These were like surrogate governments almost, these chartered companies, as they were often called. So the Dutch West India Company, in the 1600s then, was the pioneer in this kind of multinational, globalized prosecution of the slave trade. And apparently, a large number of the shareholders, the stockholders, in this Dutch West India Company were Jews. The Jews had been chased out of Portugal and Spain. They had been chased out of all kinds of places. They found some respite from their wanderings in Holland. They became an influential factor in Holland. And I've seen a variety of figures. This, too, is an area of some controversy. I've seen estimates varying from 25% to 50% concerning the stake of Jewish stockholders in the Dutch West India Company. But suffice it to say that they were an important element in the Dutch West India Company, which was the preeminent entity carrying on the slave trade in the early period. The Dutch West India Company was responsible for importing, you know, the earliest slaves to places like Brazil, to some parts of the Caribbean, either directly or indirectly, I think, to this country as well in a very early period in the 17th century. In many areas in the Americas, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. In Brazil, for example, in the 17th century, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. They owned a large number of the plantations. They were often very importantly positioned in other aspects, not necessarily the plantation aspects, but things like, say, the importation of slaves, things like the warehousing of slaves, things like the auctioning of slaves, things like the provisioning of slaves, things like manning slave ships, provisioning slave ships. In New England, for example, at the height of the Atlantic slave trade, rum became a major economic venture in New England, places like Providence, Rhode Island, places like Boston, and so on. And rum was a major factor in the slave trade because rum was one of the major items of trade, one of the major items that slave ships carried when they went to West Africa to trade and exchange for slaves and so on. At one point, all the rum distilleries in Boston were owned by Jews. I think there was something like 18 rum distilleries. So in all of these areas, both directly and in terms of ancillary industries feeding the slave trade, Jews were very, very important. Some of the most important slave ship owners in colonial America were Jews. You know, perhaps the best known of these is a man called Aaron Lopez. I noticed that many of these persons had Spanish or Portuguese sounding last names, and that's because they were Sephardic Jews. When this whole question arose, you know, around my involvement in all this, many Jews were heard to say that there were no Jews in America prior to the 1880s. In fact, Nathan Glaser, a very famous academic out of Harvard University, who should know better, he actually wrote that there's no way that Jews could be responsible for the slave trade in America, since there were no Jews here, he said, before 1880. Of course, there were European Jews here in the 19th century before 1880, German Jews and so on. But there were Sephardic Jews here from the very beginning. From the 17th century, there were Sephardic Jews coming in here to New York, and later to other places. So hence the Spanish-sounding names, names like Nunez, names like Lopez, names like Castro, interestingly enough, names like Ferreira, Herrera, Gomes, Gomez. All of these names, interestingly enough, suggested Jewish origin in colonial times.
First Masonic Lodge was in Newport because it was basically Jewish traders who had ships going there. The first synagogue, they established a synagogue there.
So Aaron Lopez was out of Newport, Rhode Island. He was one of the largest slave ship owners in colonial America. This man had a fleet of ships for many years. He sent his ships to West Africa. They traveled from West Africa to the Caribbean, to Barbados, to Jamaica, St. Thomas, places like that. He had members of his family situated in the Caribbean. He had a whole network going on, and you know, and he brought slaves back here as well. Many of his slaves helped to build some famous synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island in colonial times.
What is the message of Amsterdam? exploit your fellow man to the fullest extent possible. And that's, I think, the legacy that Holland, Calvinism and these Judaizers left with Holland. There's a Babylonian Talmud and a Palestinian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud was codified in the 7th century. And so after that, what you have are commercial centers. Like Prague, for example, was a big Jewish commercial center for trade in slaves and salt. They had contact with the East because they were selling Slavic slaves. And Prague was kind of an entrepot for that type of thing. And
so they were selling European slaves to
To people in Spain, for example. Yeah, anybody wanted to buy them. They had contacts in the East, and gradually, as this campaign of conversion took off in the West, the Jews who did not want to convert gradually gravitated toward the East. And at this point, it was Poland that became what they called the Paradisus Judaeorum, the paradise of the Jews, beginning in around the 13th century, which was about when the campaign started to kick off, the conversion campaign. And so the Jews gradually migrated there. Gradually, they were given rights, and in a sense, this was the beginning of the problem. They were given special status, and that status allowed them. They exploited that status through their main weapon was usury.
With usura, hath no man a house of good stone, each block cut smooth and well-fitting. By usura, caramacy is unbridled.
One of the articles by Ivo Pogonowski that we published had a picture of the Jew and the Polish peasant. And the Jew is sitting behind his desk, and there's a big bottle of vodka there, and the Polish peasant is scratching his head. Well, what we're talking about here is the Jew has lent him money. And the Polish peasant, and he poured him some vodka to make him more, you know, likely to sign on the dotted line. And the Jew is scratching his head because he can't figure out what compound interest is all about. And how he keeps paying him money, and it never seems to pay down. So the Jews took over Poland, and Poland began to expand because on this borrowed money, and they expanded into the East, and they expanded into Cossack territory. And basically, everywhere the Jew went, he alienated the local population until the reaction came, and that was the Chmielnitsky pogroms of 1648. So for basically a 400-year period, they took part in the expansion of Poland and alienated everyone, and there was this huge reaction. Where Chmielnitsky was a Cossack who had been cheated of wife and money by a Jew and organized the resistance, and it was violent resistance, and now you found the Poles defending the Jews to some extent, but that was the beginning of the end of Poland. The Polish ruling class was a land-based aristocracy. And land-based aristocracies always have trouble with money. In a sense, the feudal period in Europe was basically you owned the land and you had people on the land and those people owed you X number of bushels of grain. But you need money right now. So how are you going to transfer those long-term prospects into short-term cash? Well, that's where the Jew came in terms of lending money. This was the case much later in Poland than, let's say, in Italy, which was the forefront of economic development in Europe, the city-states in Italy. So this is basically how they took control of the Polish aristocracy, by lending money. They did the same thing in England. They lent the landed aristocracy money, and if the Jew lends you money, you become the slave of the Jew. The classic instance of this was Winston Churchill, whose family was deeply involved, and he became a representative of Jewish interest because they forgave his debts. That's how they got their hold over the Polish aristocracy. Because the Polish aristocracy felt that they could not engage in industrial, or they couldn't, for example, make whiskey. That was beneath the dignity of the Polish aristocracy. So they would give licenses to the Jews. Well, the Jews exploited this. as a way of taking control of the peasantry. They used alcohol as one of their cultural weapons of cultural warfare. And that was a constant tradition among the Jews and was brought over here, and it's dealt with in Henry Ford's International Jew. There's a chapter on nigger gin in Henry Ford's book, which is basically this alcohol with some white woman, her dress hanging over her shoulder, that was sold to the black population as a way of exploiting them and sort of getting this. This was the tradition that they had brought over from Poland, where the Polish aristocracy had simply licensed them as alcohol producers. And the final moment came at the end of the 18th century, when Poland was wiped off the face of the map by the three Prussia, Austria, and Russia. So they basically had the partition of Poland. This meant that all of those Jews in the Paradisus Judaeorum, where they had all of these rights in Poland, were now suddenly found themselves on the western border of Russia, in a country that did not believe in equal rights for anyone. It was totally anti-Enlightenment. I mean, it was the dark, you know, it was a throwback to another era. And so as a result, the Jews were unhappy. I mean, very unhappy. And you see to this day this ancestral hatred of Russia among the Jews. And the collapse of the Soviet Union, Paul Wolfowitz announces, we're going to put 6 divisions in Estonia. Well, wait a minute, Paul, what are we talking about here? The war is over. It is something that goes real deep, this Jewish hatred of Russia. And it began with this group of people now isolated. They're not citizens. They are not going to be allowed to have the rights of citizens. They're isolated in these shtetl, in a group area called the Pale of the Settlement. And the crucial issue is, this is precisely the border with the West. So the Jews now become involved in smuggling, revolutionary activity, all sorts of technological advances like dynamite. The first person who brought dynamite into Russia was a Jew, and he brought it into Russia to blow up the railroad tracks that the Tsar was traveling on. And this is, beginning at this point, Russia has a huge revolutionary problem on its hands, which it could not solve. It tried to solve in a humane fashion. Solzhenitsyn brings this out in his book, 200 Years Together, which has not been translated into English because of Jewish veto. A rabbi vetoed this. So you cannot read this book in English. You know, this is a Nobel Prize winner, one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, and his book is not going to be translated into English because Jews have veto power over the publishing industry in the United States. And in this book, Solzhenitsyn talks about the problems from the beginning. From the beginning. The beginning of the partition of Russia, Russia had swallowed something that it could not digest. And so the Tsar hears that there are reports of starvation in the Ukraine. Well, wait a minute. Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. How is it that people are starving? What's the answer to that question? The answer is the Jews. The Jews had lent money to the Ukrainian farmers, and so the farmers couldn't pay it back, and so they owned the grain harvest, and they were diverting all the grain to alcohol rather than to bread, and people were starving to death in the richest agricultural area of Russia. And so the Tsar, well, we have to deal with this. Well, let's turn the Jews into farmers. Well, that failed, because the Jew is not going to work as a farmer, because farming is hard work. And so you give the Jew a plow, what's he going to do? He'll sell it. You know, any farm implements, he sells them and tries to then take that money and parlay that into something else. So that failed. And so as a result, you have this increasing revolutionary ferment in the Pale of the Settlement that leads to the assassination of the Tsar in 1881. I've been in St. Petersburg, where he fell on the ground. They built this elaborate Russian Orthodox church, the Church of the Sacred Blood, Precious Blood. And it's an anomaly because it looks like the Disneyland version of a Russian Orthodox church in the middle of a city, St. Petersburg, that is nothing but Greek temples. So it's like this resurgence of Russian nationalism as the response to Jewish aggression right there in the heart of St. Petersburg. But it didn't work. It didn't work. There was something that the Tsar, the Romanovs, could not come to grips with Jewish revolutionary behavior.